All right, well, I'm going to amuse you for an hour or so by pretending to be a phenomenologist. And I'll be describing some work done in collaboration with Sean Carroll. Alan Kostelecki. Charles Lane. And Takemi Okamoto. Takemi's a graduate student at Chicago. Sean, I think you all know. Alan is at Indiana, and I haven't met Charles Lane. So I can't tell you much about him. So I'm going to start out with a little bit of motivation. I was told I should be pedagogical, so I will say a few things about the structure of non-commutative field theory, even though I think this is familiar to most of you. I'll then describe the non-commutative generalization of QED to first order in the non-commutivity parameter. And then what I'm actually going to be interested in is testing the possibility that QED is actually described by a non-commutative field theory in nature. And I'm going to discuss a particular set of tests, experimental tests of that idea, known as clock comparison tests, as applied to non-commutative QED. And then I'll conclude. So there are a number of interesting reasons why it's interesting to study non-commutative field theory. One is that it has some analogies to string theory. Particularly in the mix of UV and IR behavior, something I'm not really going to discuss today, which will be, today I'll just be talking about the classical level. There's been an upsurge in interest in this topic following the work of Kahn, Douglas, and Schwartz that showed that it arises as a limit of string theory. And so in our general program of understanding string theory in as many different regimes and variation of parameters as possible, it's an interesting limit of string theory to try to understand. More recently, we've understood that it has non-commutative field theories have soliton solutions, and some of these soliton solutions can be viewed as D-brains. And there are some nice analogies to Witten's cubic open string field theory, which I think are going to be discussed next week. Now, those are all theoretical motivations. As far as I know, non-commutative field theory has not been proposed as a solution to a hierarchy problem or the cosmological constant or the common cold. But well, it probably has been proposed as a solution to the cosmological constant problem, since everything has been proposed as a solution to the cosmological constant problem. But nonetheless, even without any definite theoretical motivation, it would be nice, it's, you know, an interesting question to ask whether any of this structure actually be realized in nature. Now, we are not the first to ask that question or to try to answer it. And there are various limits that have been discussed in the literature, which I'm not going to discuss in much detail. But the ones that I understand carefully, I think, are less stringent than the one that we'll describe. And it may be possible to improve on what we've done. But the goal here is going to be to try to apply this to this formalism of non-commutative field theory to the theory that we understand best experimentally, that is QED, and to eventually try to derive some bounds on to what degree nature could be non-commutative.
Before you get logically through you. Is there a notion of effective field theory that's useful here, or shouldn't we be talking about the non-commutative standard model, or whatever? I mean, because of the infrared IR mixing, infrared UV mixing, is there a
Well, I'm going to
maybe separate out QED from the rest of the standard model.
Both of the questions you're asking are interesting, and I don't have a complete answer. All I can tell you is what I'm going to do, which is to take non-commutative QED treated classically. We're not going to worry about whether quantum corrections induce additional terms that are not of the form that are there in the classical action. I'm going to treat it to first order in the non-commutivity parameter, and I'm going to assume that for the calculations that I'm actually going to be looking at involving calculation of various atomic matrix elements, that I can ignore anything having to do with embedding QED in the standard model. There are some theoretical issues about whether a non-commutative standard model exists, and there are issues about whether quantum corrections might change the bounds, but I think, if anything, they might make that, those issues might make for more stringent bounds. So it may be that as I go along, maybe you'll have a more precise criticism or question about what I'm doing, but hopefully it'll become fairly clear.
Okay. I'm saying whether it can be realized in nature. Of course, it could be realized in nature, not in the standard model, but in some kind of sensor. And then presumably you get weaker bounds from that.
Well, I'm going to specifically ask whether it's realized in QED. That's what I know how to analyze theoretically, and that's where the best experimental bounds are. It's possible that it's realized in some hidden sector, or maybe only gravity is non-commutative, and something really perverse. I don't have anything to say about that. The bounds are undoubtedly much weaker. So,
does it make sense to have some fields in the non-commutative and not others?
Yeah.
Well, I think so.
You can have closed strings and not see it.
Yeah, I mean,
at leading order. Yeah.
Could you imagine two different brains would be feeling one with that?
It's clear this isn't a phenomenological audience. All right, so, this is a brief review, and I think you all sort of know this, but I'll go through it quickly anyway. Formulating a non-commutative field theory or non-commutative geometry, there's a very general idea which has been formulated mathematically to take some manifold M, and you can capture all the topology of M and some of the geometry in terms of a commutative algebra of functions on M. And in some cases, one knows how to deform this to a non-commutative algebra of functions so that you define some kind of a product. So it's the ordinary product of function, plus then there's some kind of small parameter, sometimes thought of as h-bar, and some map from the algebra of functions times itself to functions, and then perhaps higher order corrections. Then if you can define that, you can sort of define the non-commutative version of M by generalizing the algebraic relationship between topology and algebra to this non-commutative situation. Now, this is a general formalism, and it has a long history and was actually applied by Kahn to the standard model, but not in the form that we currently are studying non-commutative field theory. So the form of this that I'm going to be discussing has the star product of two functions being the ordinary product of functions plus a term which looks like a Poisson bracket with theta being the symplectic form. And with this kind of star product, the star commutator of coordinates is equal to I theta ij. So we can say, in a sense, that this takes a space. In this case, the space that we're going to be considering is just R2n, and turns it into a non-commutative space. All right, that is R2n theta. Now, this sort of structure is really modeled after something that we know very well. That is, it's modeled after the structure of quantum mechanics. So in physics, we can recognize this structure in the following way. If I take a function on phase space, then in quantum mechanics, I want to associate that to an operator acting on Hilbert space. And although we don't usually worry about this in quantum mechanics courses, this requires some ordering prescription. And a standard ordering prescription is Weyl ordering. And using Weyl ordering to associate operators to functions on phase space, one finds that the product of functions, which of course is non-commutative, is related to the star product of functions in the following way. So here I was considering just R2, but you can generalize this to a phase space of any quantum mechanical system, and the phase space I'll be considering is R2n. So by generalizing this and replacing h-bar by theta ij, one gets a formulation of non-commutative geometry or non-commutative field theory. And there are two ways of thinking about this. Either the fields are functions on R2n multiplied using the star product, or you can use this Weyl correspondence to map this to a situation where the fields are operators on Hilbert space multiplied by the usual product of operators. And these two formalisms are completely equivalent. Now, this operator formalism is the most convenient for many investigations, particularly those involving solitons, but it's really not necessary for what I want to discuss, so I will just stick to the first one, where we have functions on R2n multiplied with the star product. So this is what I'll be considering. All right, so the particular kind of non-commutative theory that I'm going to be interested in is non-commutative U1 gauge theory, because I'm going to be interested in generalizing QED. And this can be formulated in terms of a field strength, which looks like that of Yang-Mills theory. The hats is the notation of Seiberg and Witten and does not denote operators as it did over here, which has a gauge invariance, which for infinitesimal gauge transformations looks like delta A mu hat is d mu lambda hat plus I commutator lambda hat A mu hat. Again, this is a star commutator. So this is a non-abelian gauge symmetry, which is why the field strength and the gauge transformation laws look like those of non-abelian gauge symmetry. So if we look at this in the operator language, then this non-commutative U1 gauge symmetry maps to the group of unitary transformations on Hilbert space, which sometimes people write as U infinity, although I actually think that neither one of those is correct mathematically, and if someone really wants to know, I'll tell them what I think is correct mathematically, but it doesn't really have much to do with this talk either, so I'm going to gloss over that. And one can also add matter fields, and to my knowledge in the literature, it's only known how to add matter fields in one of the following representations. So you can add fields which are in the adjoint representation, meaning that under a gauge transformation, phi transforms by u phi u bar, where u is e to the I lambda, and again the exponential is expanded out using star products. You can have fields which are in the fundamental, where phi hat goes to u phi hat, the fundamental bar, where phi hat goes to phi hat u bar, or you could have a singlet with phi hat being gauge invariant. And there are obvious corresponding covariant derivatives for each of these cases, which you get just by writing down the analogous formula, say, in UN gauge theory. This is sort of like UN as n goes to infinity. Now, there's a little bit of an ambiguity here if you want to generalize QED to the non-commutative situation, because in the commutative limit, where theta ij goes to 0, states in the adjoint or in the singlet representation will have charge 0 in the commutative U1 theory, and states in the fundamental or anti-fundamental will correspond to states that have charge 1 or minus 1. So if we want to write down non-commutative QED and we want to add matter fields, it's clear that the electron and anti-electron or proton or anyway, states that have charge plus or minus 1 should be in the fundamental or anti-fundamental. But neutral states could either be in the adjoint or the singlet, and those would both agree with what we know in the commutative limit. So there's a little bit of an ambiguity. And I will take neutral states, like the neutron, to be in singlets. I think one actually might get better bounds if you took them to the adjoint, but the most conservative thing is to assume that they're in the singlet representation and therefore don't couple at all to the non-commutative theory.
Can you take products of these representations?
Not that I know of. I don't know any theorems about what's possible and what's not possible, but there are. I remember looking at this question a little bit, and it doesn't seem, as far as I remember, possible to make tensor product representations. I think the problem is, roughly speaking, that if you consider UN and you consider the n-dimensional representation acting on n-dimensional complex space, if I take Cn times Cn, that's C2n, so I get a 2n-dimensional representation, which I can decompose into irreps. But if I have unitary transformations acting on Hilbert space, Hilbert space times Hilbert space is isomorphic to Hilbert space. So somehow taking tensor product doesn't really do anything. But this might be a wrong hand-waving argument. I don't know. But anyway, I haven't seen in the literature anybody discuss how to do representations other than these. But it's an interesting question and would have to be solved in order to write down a non-commutative standard model. Okay, finally, one fact that I'm going to use is that there is a map which says if I take, so if I let A mu and lambda be the gauge field and gauge parameter, of commutative U1, and I denote the gauge field and the gauge parameter of non-commutative U1, then when we do gauge theory, what we do is we consider the space of gauge fields, let's say A, and then the actual configuration space, or the space of fields that we integrate over in the path integral, are the space of gauge fields modulo gauge transformations. And we have that same sort of setup in the non-commutative theory, where there's some space of gauge, non-commutative gauge fields A hat, and there's some subspace of this, which I get by taking A hat and modding out by gauge transformations by lambda hat. And there is a map between this configuration space and this configuration space, which is known as the Cyber-Gwitten map. So I'm not going to go through the evidence for this. I mean, there have been recent papers working out this map explicitly. It's sort of subtle in that it's not a map just from A to A hat and lambda to lambda hat, because you can't map an abelian group to a non-abelian group. Rather, it's a map between the physical configuration spaces. And that map is given to order theta, which is all I will need, by the following set of transformations. So the non-commutative gauge field is related to the commutative gauge field like this. And if we add matter fields in the adjoint, in the fundamental representation, which we'll want to describe electrons, then this has a small generalization. And there's also a map for the lambdas, but that won't enter into what I need to do. Okay, so are there any questions about non-commutative field theory?
What happens to the quarks?
Sorry?
The quarks?
The quarks. Well, that's a good question, too. I'm going to assume that I can write down non-commutative QED involving electrons, protons, and neutrons, and not worry about how the quarks are bound up into protons and neutrons. It's an interesting question, which again has to do with how you add things with varying U1 charges and what happens when you have bound states. But I'm a phenomenologist today, and I'm not going to worry about those theoretical issues. I'm just going to do the most obvious thing and, you know, put a...
The discussion is always below the electroweak symmetry breaking scale, so like
yeah.
Talk about
the Q2 from C1. Right. All the experiments I'm going to look at are low-energy experiments. And I'm going to assume that I can, that it's correct to decouple non-commutative U1 from whatever else is going on. Now, I understand there are UVIR problems, but I'm going to be...
Also, that the scale set by theta then is presumably much lower than the electroweak scale.
But, yeah, that would seem funky logical if theta is quite below the electroweak scale.
Well, the boundary again on theta is above the electroweak scale.
So why don't we need to talk about SU2 plus?
Well, all the energies involved in the experiment are very small. I'm not looking at high energy processes.
You're looking at what corrections to the effective action in you.
Well, why don't I tell you what I'm going to do, and then you can complain about it. No, but I might. let's see. Actually, this is the perfect kind of talk, because I can respond to the theoretical questions by saying I'm a phenomenologist, and I can respond to any of the phenomenological questions by saying I'm just a formal string theorist and can't be expected to answer such detailed experimental questions. All right, so I can now tell you what I mean by non-commutative QED in three space and one time dimensions. So I will choose a constant theta mu nu, and I'll choose it so that theta mu nu is positive, which means there's a frame in which theta 0 I is equal to 0, and I have only a non-zero theta ij, which avoids problems with unitarity. I could also choose a coordinate system since theta ij is a 3-by-3 anti-symmetric tensor, I could always write theta ij in the form 0 theta minus theta 0, 0. It always has to have one zero eigenvalue, one skew zero eigenvalue, since it's odd dimensional. And then I could break up R3 as a non-commutative R2 times R. I'm not going to do that. I'll just leave theta ij arbitrary, but there's always some coordinate system in which this is the case. All right, so then my Lagrangian for non-commutative QED, well, I guess I'll write it down for electrons, but it has an obvious generalization to include states with positive charge, is I over 2 psi hat star gamma mu d mu psi minus m psi bar hat psi hat. So, in other words, it's just the usual Lagrangian. And as I already said, F mu nu is d mu a nu minus d mu a mu minus I commutator. Now, this theory still has some symmetry. In particular, it preserves CPT, and it preserves energy and momentum conservation. But other discrete symmetries are violated, and it breaks Lorentz invariance. And it breaks rotational invariance in particular.
Excuse me. In the generic case, the determinant of theta mu is non-zero, right? And therefore, there is no frame in which you can write it as a singular matrix.
If it's an odd, anti-symmetric matrix, the determinant is
small. Theta 0, 1 equals 5, and theta 2, 3 equals 7.
No, no. I'm,
so then you cannot remove the prime direction.
Sorry, I didn't. Say it again.
You know, in the generic case, you cannot choose a frame in which the only non-zero component of theta is in the 1-2 direction. You have both 0-1 component and 2-3 component, and you know any transformation doesn't change the determinant.
Okay. I guess you're right. Well, it doesn't. This is all I really. That was an aside. Maybe it was a wrong aside. I think it is true I can choose theta 0 r to be 0 if theta squared is positive.
No,
that's just a boost.
It's like saying I can go to a frame in which the electric field is 0.
Yeah, you cannot go to a frame where electric field is 0.
You know, for a vacuum, you can't do it. E dot B is not 0.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's what
when you lambda, whatever.
I guess I need a condition on theta squared and theta theta dual, I guess is what I need. I need theta theta dual to be 0.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I should have just said I'll assume that the only non-zero components are theta ij. All right, so what are we going to do? Well, because this breaks Lorentz invariance, it's natural to ask what the bounds are on Lorentz invariance. And this is a question that has been studied in great detail by various people. Georgi and Glashow have studied it. Coleman and Glashow have studied it. And two of my collaborators, Kostolecki and Lane, have studied the question for a wide variety of systems. And have developed a kind of general framework where they write down a general generalization of the standard model, which preserves gauge invariance and conserves energy momentum, but in general violates everything else. And they've studied how to put bounds on the various parameters. So the first thing to do is to reduce this to the framework of Kostolecki and Lane so that we can apply their formalism. So to do that, I'm going to do the following. I'll expand, I mean, we presumably know that theta is small in the real world, so I'll expand the star products to first order and theta. And then I will use the Seiberg-Witten map, again to first order and theta, to write the action in terms of ordinary fields with standard gauge invariants. Now, some of the papers putting bounds on non-commutative field theory have not, or at least all of them that I know of, have not really done this second step. They've just expanded to first order of the star products and then treated the resulting fields as ordinary fields. I think that's wrong unless you're extremely careful, because the Hadid fields do not obey standard gauge transformation laws, and therefore you have to be extremely careful about choosing a gauge. If you want to do any computations of matrix elements in atomic states, then you would have to go back and reformulate atomic physics in terms of Hadid variables if you really wanted to do a consistent computation. So I think that this gives the, and I'm not saying you couldn't do the computation in terms of the Hadid variables, but this gives by far the simplest and clearest physical interpretation of what you're doing. So one can carry this out, and you get an action, which I'll call L theta non-commutative QED, which is the ordinary action for QED, plus a correction of order theta. So the correction that you get has the following form. There are a few terms, but I guess it's worth writing them all down. This will end before the blackboard does, I hope. Although it will be a close call. All right, so this action is manifestly gauge invariant. Well, it is. It's just got size and f's in it and covariant derivatives. And it has, these are all higher dimension Lorentz violating operators. You can think of theta as being some kind of background field whose expectation value violates Lorentz invariants.
So Jeff, in two terms, you could have gotten just by expanding Dirac-Born-Imfeld. I mean, you didn't have to go through the Seiberg-Witten map and then go back again.
Yeah, but I'm a phenomenologist, and I've never heard of Dirac-Born-Imfeld. You'll have to explain that to me later.
Isn't the first term just reducible to mass times sine bar sine?
The first term?
The math equation.
Sorry, is this one?
Yeah. V slash sine is M sine.
Oh, well.
What is Reynolds?
Yeah, you could. On shell, you could do that.
But the equations of motion
change. Well, they're, I think he's saying the equation of motions are changed, but they're changed to order of theta. So to order first order in theta, you can use the zeroth order in theta equation. Okay, so how do we put bounds on theta from this action? All right. Well, we now get to the part of the talk where you could really ask me embarrassing questions. So, theta ij, is, well, who knows what it is, but it's presumably constant with respect to something like the cosmic background radiation, or some preferred frame of the universe. It certainly is not going to be constant in our frame of reference where we're rotating with a 24-hour period. Therefore, theta in the lab will change with time, with a 24-hour period plus perhaps some other additional changes. So the idea is to have two clocks. Here's clock one, and here's clock two. And you let these clocks run, and you compare how fast they run. And you choose these two clocks so that their period, well, the period will in general be changed in a way that I'll discuss by delta L here and here. And if these changes are different because of the structure of the clocks, then a test of the frequency of these two clocks will give you a bound on theta.
So Jeff, the point is that the composition is different, not the orientation of the clocks or the location of the clocks. It's a composition test?
Well, in the actual experiment that gives us the best bound is an experiment, I don't know if it's Prestage or Prestage or how you pronounce his name, but anyway, some people at NIST. And in their first clock is a hydrogen maser, and their second clock involves looking at a hyperfine transition in a certain beryllium ion in a background magnetic field of about 1 Tesla. So in this case, using a little bit of formalism, which I'll sort of sketch for you, you can show that the two nuclear, this is basically involves, as I understand it, a nuclear spin flip transition. And those two states have equal shifts to first order in theta. And so the frequency of this hydrogen maser doesn't change to first order in theta. On the other hand, this involves a different set of transitions, and the matrix elements differ between the two states that you look at the transition in. And so this is sensitive to the changes to first order in theta. And so, I don't know if you want to call that exactly the composition, it just involves looking at different transitions in different systems, and the states you're looking at the transitions between will have shifts that depend upon the matrix elements, and sometimes those matrix elements will vanish for reasons, well, symmetry reasons, essentially.
But shouldn't it also change if you just change your orientation? You don't have rotation invariance anymore, so you just
right.
Rotate your clock by 90 degrees.
Well, that's what, I mean, you are rotating your clock. You're rotating your clock by letting the Earth rotate. You're rotating the clock, or in this case, you're rotating the clock and the magnetic field relative to some kind of axis picked out by theta by letting theta vary with time.
You're referring only to experiments that have actually accidentally already been done, which is why you... I mean, otherwise you could...
Well, I don't think they were done accidentally. I mean, they were...
they're relevant, but theta is accidental.
Not very accidental. They were looking for tests of Lorentz violation. They were looking at...
Why don't they just rotate the clock?
Well, I'm not an experimentalist.
Why do you have to, you know, wait for the Earth to carry it around its axis?
Well, you'd have to rotate both of the clocks. You'd have to make sure that you rotate them both exactly the same. I don't know.
Jeff, theta's supposed to be time dependent. Is it obvious why you didn't have the derivatives of theta in your long list across the board? They wouldn't be gauging variants?
Well, I'm assuming that there's some, you know, cosmic background frame where theta is constant. And yeah, it's just time dependent in the lab, and I can get that time dependence by just changing to the lab coordinates.
You have down both dimension 5 and dimension 6 operators here. Are they comparable, or can you just keep dimension 5?
I'll tell you what I'm going to keep in just 1 second. Maybe I should leave that for just a moment. All right, so what we need to do is to compute the energy shifts of some set of atomic levels that are the ones that are actually measured in this clock comparison experiment. So there are various steps in this, which I'll just sort of sketch. First of all, this experiment is done in a background magnetic field that gives you some Zeeman splitting between various hyperfine levels, and then you look at the transitions between those levels. So we need to include a background magnetic field. So I'll do that by taking F mu nu and replacing it by F mu nu plus F mu nu, where this is the background field. And if you do that, then the term in delta L, after a little bit of minor manipulation, is this plus additional terms. There are additional corrections, but this is the one that I'm going to focus on for getting the bound. And here, C mu nu is equal to minus Q over 2 times F mu lambda theta lambda nu. Is there any more white chalk?
How about mini books?
If I only have spatial components for F and theta, I could write Cij as Q over 2 theta I Bj minus delta Ij B dot theta, where as usual Bi is in terms of F, and I've defined theta I similarly. So this coefficient depends on the background field and depends upon theta, and is going to be the one that I analyze for getting these tests. Now, this has a sort of interpretation, if you want, as saying that I have some little area element, which is sort of like a cell in my phase space, or cell in ordinary space, because the coordinates don't commute, and there's some normal to that determined by theta, and then I've got some magnetic field, B. So kind of like in the quantum Hall effect, the physics here depends upon the flux through a unit cell. This is a unit cell in our non-commutative space.
So could it be that the Earth's axis is unfortunately so oriented that even though...
Right. You can always wait a little while and then do the test a few months later, I guess.
Or you could rotate the clock.
Yeah. All right, but what?
Or you could rotate the clock.
How much time do I, how much longer do I have to keep doing this? All right, so this is the term I'm going to be looking at. Take the non-relativistic limit of this in the usual way. And this gives you a correction to the Hamiltonian, which involves summing over particle species. I'll sum over protons and electrons, assuming that the neutrons were singlets. Sum over all the particle species in whatever system you're looking at, and then the mass of that species, CJK, PJ, PK, over the mass. And then you need to analyze this matrix element. Now, this involves some hard things and some easy things, so let me first discuss the easy things. M is the mass, M is either the mass of the proton or the mass of the neutron. W is supposed to run over protons and electrons. The neutrons, I'm assuming, don't contribute because they were singlets. If they'd been in the adjoint, then there might, in fact, be contributions, but...
No, but I'm just confused about your M. You're dividing by M and multiplying?
Sorry, there's a squaring. it's useful from a phenomenological point of view. This seminar is not supposed to be a joke. It's useful because the matrix element of this is proportional to velocity squared, and so you know what typical velocity squareds are for electrons or protons or nuclei or in atoms, and this pulls out an overall scale that has dimensions of energy. So it's useful to write it this way, except I forgot the squared on there. All right, so we'll be interested in various systems like the beryllium 9, and we can label those states to a good approximation by the total angular momentum and the z component of angular momentum, chosen to be along the magnetic field in the usual way. And then we need to sum over all particle species and evaluate matrix elements of the perturbation. So some basic quantum mechanics, which is kind of elementary, but nonetheless. So Pi, Pj is a second rank tensor. I can decompose it in terms of spherical operators of various rank. And the angular momentum 1 piece is 0, obviously, because I can't make it anti-symmetric on I and j. The angular momentum 0 part of this operator is clearly not sensitive. The violations of rotational invariance. So we can drop this as well. And then in this term, since we're considering matrix elements between the same state, the same initial and final state, by the Wigner-Eckhart theorem, only Q equals 0 contributes. And the T to 0 part of this is proportional to P1 squared plus P2 squared minus 2P3 squared. So if you want to compare this to the formalism in a paper by Kostolecki and Lane, one can then write the matrix element of this perturbation as follows. All right, so here the following factors are. A sum over matrix elements, and for convenience, these are all related to the matrix element of maximum MF using the Clebsch-Gordan, or using Wigner-Eckhart. In order to do that, you get a ratio of Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, which is this quantity I called MF tilde. So for order of magnitude estimates, this is typically something like 10 to the minus 5 for electrons, 10 to the minus 2 for protons. Since it involves the expectation value of p squared over the mass of the particle squared, and that's the typical size for electron and velocities and proton kinetic terms. And, well, this is clearly of order 1, more or less. And then finally, CQ tilde is the mass times C11 plus C22 minus 2C33 from this analysis in terms of spherical tensor operators. All right, so a very crude estimate. So this goes like, say, the mass of a proton. The protons will give the dominant contribution because this is much smaller for electrons, times Q times the typical value of theta times the typical value of P, of B. And this is roughly 10 to the 11 times theta in CGS units. That is, it's dimensionless, and if theta is expressed in terms of centimeters squared, and you take B to be 1 tesla. So if you just take these estimates for the matrix elements and assume the differences are comparable to that, and you use the fact that in this experiment, they have a transition with a frequency of a couple of hundred megahertz, and they are able to measure the change in frequency to an accuracy of about 10 to the minus 4 hertz, then you get a bound that theta has to be less than or equal about 10 TeV to the minus 2. Which I expressed in terms of energies rather than in terms of centimeters, just because that's more, more what we're used to quoting bounds in terms of. Now, there are some subtleties which I have glossed over. And these subtleties, well, the subtlety is nuclear physics. if you want to know more about this, you really should look at the papers by Kostolecki and Lane. But the problem is the following. There's a very naive model. My sum total knowledge of nuclear physics is that I remember that I once knew the semi-empirical mass formula. But there's a naive model called the Schmidt model, where all the angular momentum of the nucleus is carried by one sort of valence nucleon. And for this particular nucleus, in the Schmidt model, there is one valence neutron. And the closed shell inside of that doesn't contribute to the matrix element, so strictly speaking, this calculation would give zero if you use this very naive model. There are other experiments that use smaller magnetic fields and use other nuclei where you have protons, valence protons. They give bounds which are somewhat weaker than this. However, this model is very naive, and my understanding is that in a more sophisticated treatment, which is necessary to agree with more detailed experimental information, you need an admixture of protons here, which is, you know, sort of order one. I mean, maybe it's 20% or 30%. And so in any realistic model, I think there's some component of the proton as well. And you then get a bound, which is essentially what I've quoted. So one can question the nuclear physics exactly how accurate it is. It's undoubtedly uncertain, but by factors of 2 or 3 at worst, I think. And so I don't think it really affects this bound, where we were fairly conservative in making various estimates. So there are theoretical issues. I guess in conclusion, they're the ones that people have raised. Does it really make sense to treat the proton in non-commutative QED without worrying that it's a bound state of quarks? Is it okay to not worry about quantum corrections? There are UV-IR problems. Is there a non-commutative standard model? If you could only write down things that have charge plus minus 1 or 0, then it's hard to incorporate hypercharge, because for hypercharge you need states that don't have ratios of charges, which are just plus or minus 1. But anyway, within the context of trying to put a bound on non-commutative QED, this is what we get. And I think if anything, one can probably do better by resolving some of these theoretical issues. It seems unlikely that we're going to see non-commutivity in nature in the near future, but who knows? So.